Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I appreciate getting the Mr. Gore treatment with an extra song before the sermon. It's nice. I also appreciated the giving the announcement as it was intended on the rafting. Thank you. Good job on that. So, good afternoon, everyone. All right. So there are a number of classic children's games that many of us played as children and may have played as adults. Three classic games aimed at 3 to 5 year in that 3 to 5 year old range are, at least that I remember, both as a child and as a parent of young children, are Hi-Ho Cheerio, or Cheerio, Candyland, and Chutes and Ladders. Candyland was my favorite of these. I enjoyed all the pictures, the graphics, and it's pretty fun. So I don't see any 3 to 5 year olds, but if there are any, and we want to bring that game in for an after-church activity this winter, I'll play along. It's fun. Chutes and Ladders, on the other hand, can be a game that's a little bit frustrating. So probably many, if not all of you, understand the game. But in this game, you navigate on the board, moving from left to right. As you get to one side of the board, you go up a level and then back across. And you go to the top of the board. The first one there is the winner. So the path that you take is determined by a spinner, mostly determined by a spinner that assigns the number of spaces that you move. However, there are chutes and ladders are scattered along the way that add an unpredictable twist. When you land on a square with a ladder, it allows you to climb up several rows and get closer to victory. While encountering a chute, the chute forces you to slide down, taking you further away from winning. These chutes, when you're playing, test your patience. Just when you think, especially as an adult, you're playing and along and you're busy and have to get on to other seemingly more important things, you're like, okay, I will play this game with my child or some young person. It's like, all right, this game's about to be over. The person closest to the end hits a chute and slides back down, and the game continues. Well, the game board associates, if you remember, chutes with bad behavior, like pulling someone's hair. So if you land on a square where it's shown a little child pulling someone's hair, you'll slide down the chute as a form of punishment. And the ladders are linked to positive actions, such as reading a book. You will then climb the ladder and get closer to winning. So in some ways, chutes and ladders offers a simplistic reflection of our own lives. When we make right choices, we draw closer to our goals. And when we make wrong choices, we have to work to recover. So in the Bible, we find numerous lists of wrongdoings and also lists of righteous behaviors. Today, we are going to explore some of these lists. We're going to examine and compare a few examples of what is wrong and what is right. So we're going to begin, and we're going to look in the book of Colossians. We'll start there, and we're going to read chapter 3, a few different sections. So two sections. So Colossians chapter 3, verses 5 through 9. This is a list that we'll start with. Now, in this chapter 3 of Colossians, the setup is, in the verses of this chapter, is that Paul writing says that we should set our minds on things that are above and not on things on the earth, so that we will appear in Christ's glory. So then verses 5 through 9, Paul explains, what are the things on the earth? So starting in verse 5, it says, therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry, because these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. Verse 7, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them, but now you yourselves are to put off all these, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds. So here Paul is writing to a church group. He's writing to a group of Christians, and he's saying these are some of the behaviors that you had before, and that these are behaviors that you need to continue to distance yourself from and put off. And then we'll drop down to verse 12, and we'll read 12 through 14. This is the list of righteous acts, righteous behaviors. Verse 12, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, Put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. So especially in this chapter, and then we'll also in the next two that we're going to compare, they're right there next to each other in the Bible. So it's quite easy to look back and forth between these two lists and say, okay, these are the things I need to make sure I'm not doing, and these are the things that I need to make sure I'm doing. Out of these lists, I picked a couple, and we'll follow this format through most of the sermon, of comparing two things. And out of these two lists, I picked out covetousness versus humility. Now, I chose these. Those don't immediately seem like antonyms of each other, but I chose them because I think there are some interesting points. Certainly when you think of humility, the antonym of humility might be pride. Covetousness, I'm not sure exactly what a good antonym of covetousness is, but you probably wouldn't think of humility. But I think when we look at these two together, which we're about to do, hopefully there'll be some insights, and it will be helpful to contrast these two. So humble people do not seek excessive attention or praise for their achievements. Humility is rooted in contentment with one's own circumstances and gratitude for what one has been given. On the other hand, let me continue. It involves recognition of one's blessings in life. Covetousness, though, on the other hand, is driven by greed and a never-ending desire for more. It often stems from a sense of dissatisfaction with one's own circumstance in an unhealthy comparison to others. So covetousness and humility, one of the differences between somebody who covets and somebody who is humble is how satisfied are you with your current conditions? And that's going to be a theme that shows up in a couple places as we go through. Going on with my comparison of humble and covetousness, humble people appreciate the contributions of others. Humble people express gratitude and are willing express gratitude to others, whereas covetousness is often accompanied with negative emotions, things like envy, jealousy, resentment to what others have and possess that we don't have. So again, humble people are going to be appreciating others. People who are coveting are not. People who are coveting are going to be looking to pull others down. Humble individuals often have a desire to serve and help others. They prioritize the needs of others above themselves. Covetousness is self-centered. It's about wanting more for yourself and seeking your own personal gains and possessions. So again, a big difference between those who are humble and those who covet are you trying to do something for yourself, or are you trying to serve others? So I want to talk about a man who I wouldn't consider as a Christian, but I think he's somebody that seems to practice humility in life. And so I'll spend a couple minutes of my time here and introduce this person. Now, I'd never heard of this term before, this name, but I think all of you will know this person as I go through it, but this man who I'm going to talk about and introduce just briefly in just a minute, he was called frequently the Oracle of Omaha. Anyone know who that is? I didn't actually do it. I should have given my wife a star this morning because she knew. She never heard that, but she figured it out. The Oracle of Omaha. He's called the Oracle because he's one of the most successful inventors or investors in the world. This is Warren Buffett. So Warren Buffett is known for many things, but he's known for humility and a modest lifestyle. Despite his vast wealth, he's maintained a frugal approach. And as a result, he's going to be able to donate a large sum of money when he passes on to various charitable causes. So he is about 92, or maybe he is exactly 92, I'm not sure. But right now, at the age of 92, he's worth about $112 billion. He's doing pretty well. That's how much money he has, so keep that in mind as we keep going. But a couple interesting points is He didn't become a billionaire until he's 50. There's still hope for me. But wait, he didn't pass the 100 billion mark until he was 90. There's still hope for everyone here, I think. My grandmother is 96, so I don't think she'll make it to 100 billion, but she's still doing well, fortunately, and I'm happy to have her around. So let me share three quotes from Warren Buffett. Number one, from Warren Buffett, he has two rules. Rule number one, never lose money. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. The second one, the stock market is a device for transferring money from the impatient to the patient. Gives some insight into his investing strategy. The third one, though, I think it's a little more impactful and important. He says, humility is the true key to success. Successful people lose their way at times. They often embrace and overindulge from the fruits of success. Humility halts this arrogance and self-indulging trap. That's some pretty good advice from Mr. Buffett. So a little bit more about Mr. Buffett, and again, talking about how he lives in a humble and frugal way. Again, somebody that has billions and billions of dollars. He has resided in the same house in Omaha, Nebraska for many decades. His home he purchased in 1958 for about $31,500, and he's lived there the whole time. He could have easily have bought up, and he could own the biggest house and the best house in America, probably, if he wanted. But he's chosen to live in a humble and modest way. He reportedly spends a modest amount on personal expenses, such as clothing and vehicles. He buys older vehicles. According to what I read, he does have a Cadillac, a very nice vehicle, but for a billionaire, a Cadillac is not much, right? He often wears a very simple attire. He doesn't engage in lavish spending. It's noted that he even eats frugally. He enjoys simple meals, even going to McDonald's. And if you were to have a meal with him, according to one article I read, don't be surprised if he pulls out a coupon and uses it to get a discount on his meal. Even on his phones, he does not splurge. Even after iPhone had been in the market, so many people needed an iPhone, he carried a simple flip phone for many, many years. He does have iPhones now, according to the one article I read, but that's because they've been given to him. So how many people who can't really afford to live and are living on credit and borrowed money, but the iPhone is a must? Warren Buffett offers a good example in some ways on how to be humble and how to not be covetous, practice being coveting. Let's compare a couple people in the Bible. We'll turn to Joshua chapter 7, and we'll read verse 20 and 21. We're going to compare Achan to Moses and think about somebody who is practicing covetousness versus somebody who's practicing humility. So we know the story. Here the Israelites had just crossed the Jordan River, and God had given them victory at Jericho, and Joshua led them to battle against the town of Ai, and they lost, and Israelites died. Joshua was so distraught. He tore his clothes. He fell down before God, and he prayed, "What happened? What did I do wrong?" God led him to the answer and what had happened, and we'll read about this in verse 20 of Joshua chapter 7. And Achan answered Joshua and said, "Indeed, I have sinned against the Lord God of Israel, and this is what I have done. When I saw the spoils of a beautiful Babylonian garment, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. And there they are, hidden in the earth in the midst of my tent with the silver under it." So here we have the example of this man who practiced coveting. But on the other hand, let's look at Moses. We'll turn to Hebrews chapter 11. We know how to get there. We were just there a few minutes ago. And we'll read verses 24 to 26. Thinking about Moses. Moses was living the good life in Egypt as a prince of Egypt. But he made a decision. In verse 24, it says, "By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. He looked to the reward." So Achan and Moses, Achan did what? He put himself first. And it ended up in death for him, but also Israel suffered. The whole nation of Israel suffered because of him and what he did. Moses, what did he do? He did not put himself first. He put God first. He put his people, the people of Israel, first. Achan was seeking personal gain. Moses was not. All right, let's move on. And let's compare. And this will turn to Galatians chapter 5, and we'll read starting in verse 19. This is probably the most obvious and clear example of comparing the list of wrong versus the list of rights. And of course, this is the works of the flesh and the fruits of the Spirit. So verse 19, it says, "Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envies, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in the past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God." This list, in one, either exactly or in some version of this, Paul had told the Galatians more than once, watch out for these things. So it must have been important for him to be repeating that to them. So that's the list of things that are wrong, that we should stop doing and make sure we distance ourselves as much as possible from. And then dropping, or the next verse, we get the fruits of the Spirit, verse 22 and 23. "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law." So here I want to compare looking at jealousies versus kindness. How do these two compare? We need to put away jealousies and bring on kindness in our lives and in our actions, in our thoughts. Just briefly, thinking about Cain. Cain is somebody who became jealous. He was jealous of his brother. And that jealousy grew and grew until the point that he murdered his own brother. That's how dangerous jealousy is. Most people who become jealous or express jealousy in their lives don't end up, fortunately, to that level, but it is a very dangerous thing that we need to distance ourselves from. So how does jealousy and kindness compare? Jealousy is primarily self-centered, focusing on one's desires, insecurities, and comparisons to others. Kindness is primarily focused on others, considering their needs, feelings, and well-being above one's own. So again, jealousy is what? Self-centered, self-focused. Kindness is focusing on others, putting others before you. Jealousy is accompanied with negative feelings. Again, evil, bitterness, resentment. Kindness, though, is associated with positive emotions. Emotions like empathy, compassion, and joy derived from helping others. Jealousy can lead to harmful behaviors. We just rehearsed what had happened with Cain. But it leads to other harmful, maybe not murder, but gossip, sabotage, seeking to harm another person, to bring them down and diminish their success. Whereas kindness, the acts of kindness are compassion, support, encouragement, generosity, aiming to uplift others. Jealousy comes out of a lack or out of feeling inadequate, not being content with what you have. But kindness can stem from contentment and gratitude. If you are content, you don't need to be jealous. If you're content, whether you have a lot or a little, which is what Paul wrote about, where he was content whether he had a lot or a little, if you are content with your current situation, you don't need to be jealous because you're not going to be looking at and wanting what others have. If you're content, you can be kind and help others. Let's consider Saul and David, probably in sermons the two most compared people of all. What happened to Saul? Saul became jealous. He became jealous of David's success, and he had no reason to be. David was helping him. David could have been a blessing to Saul. David's successes were Saul's successes, but that's not how he saw it. He became jealous, and he resented David to the point where he tried to kill David. He went down the path that Cain went down, although due to God's protection, he wasn't successful that. And Saul ended up going mad for this reason and others. But what about David's acts of kindness? David showed kindness. He was not jealous. David showed kindness and mercy. When he had a chance to kill Saul, he didn't do that. After Saul and Jonathan died, David was kind to the family, in particular to, I'll mispronounce this, I'm sure, but Mephibosheth, Saul's crippled son. He restored the land, and he let him eat at the king's table. That's how David showed kindness. David had every worldly reason to hate Saul and his family, but he didn't. He was kind. All right, let's look at a couple. So we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16 through 19. And then after this, we're going to turn to the Beatitudes. And what I like about these two comparisons is this is almost as directly as if it's possible, God is telling us what does he hate and what does he like. It's almost like God is speaking right to us. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16, and we'll read through 19. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. So that's quite a lead up, right? These things we probably want to pay attention to. If God is hating them, we should hate them too. If God is hating them, we better not be doing these things. So verse 17, a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and anyone who sows discord among brethren. So these are the things that we cannot be doing or thinking or living like. Now let's flip over to Matthew chapter 5, again into the Beatitudes. We'll read the Beatitudes, verse 3 through 12, Matthew 5. So again, Proverbs, Solomon was writing what God hates. And here in Matthew, we have Jesus Christ speaking, the Son of God, telling us what we should be doing. Again, these are things that we should be paying very good attention to, right? Verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they have persecuted the prophets who were before you. If we do these things, God will bless us. So again, we need to be focused on doing these things, doing what is right. So in this section, let's compare a proud look versus mourning. So pride versus mourning. So pride leads to an inflated ego, a haughty attitude, a tendency to look down on others or dismiss others' perspectives. Mourning leads to humility as we understand the trials that others are facing. Pride can create barriers between individuals. It leads to a competitive, divisive mindset. Mourning for others fosters connections. It draws us closer together. So pride separates us. Mourning draws us close together as we're all working towards the same thing and the same goal. There are a couple prophets in the Old Testament that in particular were those who mourned. Jeremiah is most famous, of course. He's sometimes referred to as the weeping prophet. He prayed so much, I think, that he prayed so much to God that God said, stop, that's too far. This is just going to happen. Move on. But he cared and mourned for the people and for the city and for the nation. He was so sorrowful over the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of the people. He even wrote a book of lamentations. He was so mournful, he wrote a whole book about his deep compassion and grief for the suffering that the people were going through. Nehemiah also mourned for the people. Nehemiah was with the captives. He was taken away from Judah, or his family was. And men came from Judah. And Nehemiah said, how are things going? Tell me the news. What's going on in Judah? How are things? And the men reported how things were, and it was not good. The people were distressed. The walls were destroyed. Nehemiah's reaction is recorded in chapter 1 and verse 4 of Nehemiah. Let's look at this short verse. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 4. So here, Nehemiah is sitting in the exile. I wouldn't be surprised if he was living a pretty good life there. At one point, the Israelites or the Jews were told, build houses, live your life there. God told them, this is where you're going to be, do it. Build up your houses and live there. Nehemiah could have looked down and said, well, you know, that's what I expect from those people. The Babylonians, they took the smartest, the best families, the wealthiest, the most educated people and brought them over here. I would expect those people back there to be in distress. It's I'm sure it's their fault. They're not educated. They probably don't wear shoes in the morning. They probably don't brush their teeth every day. They probably talk funny, eat too many grits, I don't know. But he could have looked down on them. He could have looked down on them and said, that's their fault. But what did he do? After he heard this terrible news, verse 4 says, so it was, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Nehemiah mourned. He did not have a proud attitude, a proud look. He did not look down on those people who were back in Judah. He cared for them and he mourned for them. So we need to be putting away our pride and becoming mournful for others who are suffering. All right, let's go back to the New Testament and look at a couple more lists. So we're going to look at Ephesians 4 and verse 31. So most of these lists that I found in the Bible and that I'm using today were written by Paul. And Paul wrote these to the churches that he was overseeing. He was writing these lists of things, whether it was the lists of wrong or the lists of right, to people who were church members, who were Christians, who were many of whom were baptized. And yet he was still warning them about what not to do. Now we are going to come to a couple lists that weren't directly, I would say, that weren't so much written to the churches. They were written about the people of the world. We'll get to those. I'll point those out. But for most of these, what we're about to read and what we have been reading is Paul and God through Paul telling us what not to do. Ephesians 4:31 says, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. We need to put these things away. Anger, clamor, whatever that is, it doesn't sound good. Evil speaking, we need to stop doing that. And then on the other hand, what should we be doing? One of the most uplifting verses maybe in the Bible, Philippians 4, verse 8. Some of you won't even need to turn there to know what that says. Philippians 4, verse 8 says, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these. So in our lives, in our thinking, in our speech, our focus should be on the things that are true, noble, just, pure, lovely, and of good report, things that have virtue, not on wrath, not on anger, not on evil speaking. So let's look about Consider evil speaking versus being praiseworthy or praiseworthy speech. Evil speaking tears others down. It spreads rumors. It causes pain, divisions, and damages relationships. Praiseworthy speech uplifts and inspires. It enables healing, positive connections, and healthy relationships. So if we are speaking in an evil way, speaking in an evil way about each other, towards each other, behind other people's back, that causes pain and division. Praiseworthy speech brings us together. Evil speaking disregards the feelings and well-being of others. It's focused on personal gain, and a desire to harm. Praiseworthy speech involves words of encouragement, uplifting others in their endeavors. So again, evil speaking is self-centered. It's tearing others down, whereas speaking in a praiseworthy way of others and to others builds up, promotes, and uplifts. Evil speaking is destructive, negative, and lacks empathy. It's praiseworthy speech is constructive, kind. It promotes trust and understanding. Let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 20. Paul was dealing with many problems in this church in Corinth, and they had some of these problems. So these things can happen and do happen in the churches as recorded in the Bible. Probably from time to time we have experienced this. We have experienced maybe others speaking in an evil way, doing evil speaking. Maybe we've been a part of that as well. Paul's writing here to the Corinthians. He says, and this is in 2 Corinthians 12, verse 20, "For I fear lest, when I come, I shall not find you such as I wish, and that I shall be found by you such that I do not wish. So I want to come to you and find you practicing Philippians 4, verse 8. But he said, I'm afraid that when I come, I'm going to find you practicing what I wrote to the Ephesians in 4:31. He said, lest there be contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, backbitings, whispering, conceit, and tumults. We need to stay away from evil speaking, and we need to not get caught up. This is something that is difficult, and if you get into a situation, think about if you reflect back when you were in school, maybe, or if you still are in school, if you're in a group of people, just as a simple example, one person's like, did you see what that teacher wore today? I mean, those were the worst pair of pants ever, and somebody else chimes in and says, yeah, that guy is the worst dresser he's the worst dresser of all. Somebody else jumps in and says something about his hair, and somebody says something about his teeth, and start tearing this person down. What a horrible thing. I think that happens all too often. We need our speech to be praiseworthy and speaking in a praising way. Let's look at Luke chapter 1 and verse 46 and verse 47. I'll just read the introduction of what is probably in your Bible called the Song of Mary. This is how she was thinking. Now, this was a very special event, and I'm assuming she didn't wake up every morning and sing or pray the way that is recorded here that she did in this very special occasion. But this is the attitude and the approach that we should be having. Verse 46 says, "And Mary said, my soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit has rejoiced in God my Savior." We need to be full of this type of thought and to be magnifying the Lord and to be rejoicing, not thinking back on our evil speaking and evil thoughts. Mary's mind was on the things that were praiseworthy, and she sang about it. That's where our focus needs to be. Just like Philippians 4, verse 8 says, we need to be meditating on these things that are praiseworthy. All right, let's look at Mark chapter 7. Continuing with our lists and our comparisons, our chutes and our ladders. Mark 7, we'll read 21 through 23, three verses here in Mark chapter 7. For from within, out of the heart of men proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man. This is what our human nature is like. Unfortunately, we have moved away from this, but we still need to continue to work on and moving further away from these types of behaviors and these thoughts. Now let's compare that to Romans chapter 12, and we'll read a little bit of a longer section here, but Romans chapter 12, verses 9 through 18. So instead of practicing the things that Christ told us about in Mark chapter 7, we need to be following the things here that God tells us through Paul in his writing. Romans chapter 12 and verse 9. And there's a lot here. There is just so much packed into these 10 verses. It says, "Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another, not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer." Verse 13, "Distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion." Verse 17, "Repay no evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of men. If it is possible, as much depends on you, live peaceably with all men." That last verse is a recognition of the world that we live in, right? As much depends on you, live peaceably. There are some things that don't depend on you and you cannot control. There's so much that we just read that if you're ever in need of what should I be meditating on, what should I be studying more, just taking this section of the Bible and looking at it step by step, piece by piece, verse by verse, there is so much packed in there that you could spend weeks, I'm sure, studying into each one of these things and meditating on each one of these things. So out of this section, I want to focus really what's stated just in Romans, but we are to abhor what is evil and cling to what is good. Let's turn over to Isaiah, and we'll read Isaiah 59, verse 7. Our human nature, again, as we read in Mark chapter 7, is to do evil and is to cling to evil. That's our human nature with Satan's influence. Isaiah 59 and verse 7 says, "Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths." So here, this is saying that men often do what? Run to evil. We've got to change that around, and we are changing that around. We need to run to what is good, and as Paul wrote, cling to what is good. So how do we cling to what is good? What are some ways that we can cling to what is good? I think it starts with guarding our heart and our mind. Pay attention to what we allow into our mind and into our heart. Guard against the negative influences and harmful media. Surround ourselves with positive and uplifting influences. If we do that, it makes it much easier to cling to what is good. Seek truth and wisdom. Pursue knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Study the scriptures daily and seek guidance from the wise. And speaking of seeking guidance from the wise, we should, of course, be seeking God's guidance. Pray for his wisdom. Pray for his will. Pray for him to help us cling to what is good. And we should, of course, based with all of that, then we need to be mindful of our choices. We need to be applying what we've learned. We need to be using God's help in making the right choices. And those are just some simple ways that we can cling to what is good. When I thought about clinging to what is good, Joseph came to mind. In real life, he did the opposite of what Isaiah 59:7 said. He ran from evil. Let's look at what happened here, the story we know well. Genesis chapter 39 and verses 11 through 12. Joseph was put in seemingly an impossible situation to do the right thing. There were so many reasons he could have succumbed and done the evil thing. There were a lot of logical, humanly logical reasons for him to have just allowed himself to follow the wrong way, to do the wrong thing. But he didn't do that. He chose what is right. He ran from evil, literally. He clung to what is good. Of course, this is the time where he was in the Potiphar's house, and Potiphar's wife grabbed him and wanted to be with him. But it happened, verse 11, but it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do the work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by the garment and saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in hand and fled and ran outside. What a good example. What an incredible thing. It seems like a simple thing, and hopefully all of us would do the same thing. But he made that right choice in a very difficult situation. Of course, this is an interesting point, and I don't think for an instant that Joseph had done anything wrong, but he was in a house with a woman with nobody else around. Just as a little side point, avoid that situation. And then what happened to him, although it was God's plan, so everything was good, and I'm not, again, saying Joseph did anything wrong, or Joshua either, right? But Don't get yourself into a situation where you could be accused of something and put in prison like Joseph was. All right, we're going to go back to Romans, and we're going to read Romans chapter 1, verses 29 through 31. Now, this is a list that is not, I would say, it's not primarily written talking about church members. It is primarily written about people in the world and the things that the people in the world do. But it was put in our Bible for a reason, so we can take a look at this and learn from this. Romans chapter 1 and verse 29. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. I'd just like to call out that people of the world are disobedient to their parents. We're not of the world, so we shouldn't be doing that. But another interesting point in here is that they didn't just practice evil. People of the world invent evil. It's like, oh, there's not enough evil around. I need to invent some more evil. So let's compare this list to Micah chapter 6, verse 8. Another favorite verse of mine. It's very simple. I like it in simple terms. Micah 6, verse 8. Here it says, Micah 6, verse 8, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." What an awesome verse here in very simple terms. So I want to consider being unmerciful, as was written in Romans, versus being merciful. So how do we turn from being unmerciful to merciful? Well, one of the most powerful ways is to practice forgiveness. Choose to let go of grudges, offenses, resentments. Extend forgiveness to those who have wronged you. And as we do that, it's helpful to keep in mind that if there was an offense, if somebody did something wrong to you and you forgive them, this is not about making that wrong thing and saying, "No, that wrong thing was right." No, if somebody did something wrong to you, it's still wrong. You're not condoning the behavior. But what you're doing is saying, I'm going to move on, let's move on. And you're forgiving that person. So it's helpful, I believe, and God deals with us in the same way, and that's where a lot of people get confused. When God gives us grace, mercy, and forgiveness, he's not saying that the sins that we committed, it's okay, it didn't matter that you did those. He's saying, that was wrong, don't do that anymore, but I forgive you for what you did. And we move on, and we can reestablish and reconnect with God and build our relationship with him. Again, we want to move from being unmerciful to merciful. We need to look for opportunities to show kindness and show compassion to others. This can be simple things like listening, offering a helping hand. It doesn't have to be grandiose, just as lending an ear. Be slow to anger and quick to listen. Instead of reacting to something, if you hear part of a story and you immediately think, that's wrong, maybe it is, but maybe it's not. Maybe you're just getting part of the story. Slow down, listen, seek to understand. In the end, maybe it's still wrong. And then anger might be an appropriate response, but many times it may not be. And of course, praying for others is an excellent way to move from unmerciful to being merciful. If you're praying for somebody, you're asking God to help this person, how can you go to that person or how can you be around that person and still feel angry feelings? That's definitely hypocrisy. But if you start by praying to God about your relationship or asking God, how can I forgive this person? He will help you. And of course, like many things, it requires practice. We don't just do it the first time or the second time or the third time. We practice mercy. We practice forgiveness. And we'll get it right. Benjamin Franklin, very interesting character in American history, did many things, a lot of good things, a lot of things that were not so good. But one of the things he did, he extended mercy to others. He helped people who couldn't help themselves. A few things that he did, he founded the first lending library in America. It provided access to people who could not afford books. So he saw a need. He saw poor people who were not as well off, who couldn't get books. And he said, I need to do something about that. He founded a library. He established the first public hospital in America. Again, there were poor people who couldn't afford to go to private hospitals. And he helped that situation. He believed in the humane treatment of prisoners and worked towards improving conditions in jails. And he advocated for rehabilitation and reform. He also organized the first volunteer fire department in Philadelphia. These are some ways that he showed mercy to those who couldn't help themselves in many cases. I'm not suggesting that we need to be doing some of the things that he did. Nothing wrong with it, but this is just an example of how he helped those who couldn't help themselves. And isn't that what mercy is? Let's consider the parable of the unforgiving servant. This is in Matthew chapter 18. Matthew 18, verses 32 through 33. What a terrible person the person we're about to read about is such a horrible person. So we're just going to read the end of the story, or towards the end of the story, but we know the setup. There was a servant who owed him money, who owed something to the master. The master showed mercy and said, I forgive you your debts. This servant went down to a more lowly servant and said, give me money right now, and he had him beaten and thrown in prison. Verse 32 says, then his master, after he called him and said to him, you wicked servant, I forgave you all the debt because you begged me. Should you not have also had compassion on your fellow servant, just as I had pity on you? This is such a stark example of how to show mercy and how to be unmerciful. And Christ put this story together in a way that we can see it. And it's almost, the story seems almost over the top, but it makes an important point. It shows a stark contrast between what mercy looks like and what the unmerciful person is like. Let's also look at Luke chapter 15 and read two verses here, verse 20 and then 28. This is, of course, probably one of the top two or three most famous or most well-known parables. This is the one of the prodigal son. So the prodigal son had left and lived the good life, so to speak, wasted all his money, lived like the poorest person in the world, and finally realized he needed to come home. Let's see how the father, this hadn't stood out to me, it's probably obvious to all of you, but what was interesting when I look at, and we're going to look at these two verses, the father showed mercy to both sons. The focus is on how the father showed mercy to the prodigal son, but he even showed mercy to his other son after his other son had the bad attitude and was jealous. So verse 20, and he arose and came to his father, and when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. The father showed such wonderful mercy to his son because he loved him. And then verse 28, the other son got angry and was mad that the father was taking such good care and celebrating the other son. Verse 28 says, but he, the other son, was angry and would not go in. Therefore, the father came out and pleaded with him. So the father cared for his other son as well. He didn't say, well, that guy's, what a bad attitude. What a terrible son he is. No, he went out and said, hey, he pleaded with him. He's like, don't be like this. Come back. He showed mercy to both. All right, a couple more lists we're going to compare before we finish up. We're going to go again to Paul's writing, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and we're going to read verse 9 and 10. This is a passage that Mr. Gore read to us about 2 months ago. I remember him going through this, and I've checked my notes, so I know it was approximately 2 months ago. My memory's not that good. I did look at my notes. So, but when he read this, he said, do any of us act in these ways? He challenged us with this, and he also, if you remember, he said there's at least one of them that I know probably, or I can't remember the words he said, but probably all of you have at least dealt with one of these on the list, and he asked which one, and I think a few people answered in the same way he was thinking, but let's read through this list. Again, this is Paul writing to a church, Paul writing to baptized people, Paul writing to Christians, and he's warning them and telling them not to behave this way. He says, do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners will inherit the kingdom of God. So again, this is showing and reemphasizing what is wrong behavior. And we may not be doing some of these things, and we shouldn't, and I doubt we are, but it continues to reinforce what is behavior that is just so wrong. We need to put that out of our lives. We need to recognize what wrong is and not start accepting that. Maybe we don't take on any of these behaviors, but we should not be accepting that kind of behavior. So that's the list of wrongdoings. Let's compare that to 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 11. Chapter 6 and verse 11. So staying away from those things. And again, if you remember, the one in the list that we just read that Mr. Gore was saying, I think all of us have dealt with this. We talked about it earlier, but it's the covetousness, something that's probably been a challenge at least once in all of our lives. 1 Timothy 6, verse 1 says, but you, O man of God, flee these things, pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. I like this word, pursue. It's something that it's not a passive thing. It doesn't just come to us. We have to pursue it. We have to pursue these things. It takes work. So let's compare unrighteousness with godliness. These are obviously very extremes of behaviors, the righteous, unrighteous versus godliness. Unrighteousness refers to actions, behaviors, beliefs that are contrary to things like justice, fairness, and love. It involves wrongdoing, immorality, dishonesty. Whereas godliness, what is that? That's conforming to virtues like justice, obedience, mercy, humility, and love. To be godly, we need to be practicing justice, obedience, mercy, humility, love. Unrighteousness, where does that come from? Well, certainly comes from Satan, but it comes from human choices and actions. It can stem from things like greed, unselfishness, ignorance, and disregard for others. Godliness comes from basing our actions and our thoughts on God's Spirit, God's teaching, and His way of life. So to act in an unrighteous way is to follow the human nature or follow Satan's way. To act godly is to follow God's way of life. Unrighteousness is a lack of adherence to moral standards. Godliness upholds moral standards, such as honesty. Unrighteous actions, of course, leads to negative consequences. There may be short-term benefits in the human world of, we live in the world of Satan, we live in his world, we live in a world filled with human nature. Sure, maybe in the short term there can be seemingly, in the world's terms, some positive outcomes from unrighteous behavior, but in the long run, there will be negative consequences, and likely in the short term as well. Godliness leads to positive outcomes in the long run. Sometimes in the short run, there's some suffering by choosing godliness over unrighteousness. But even still, often in the short run, it's a better choice. But most importantly, in the end, godliness leads to the outcome that we want. Let's briefly compare Esther and Haman when we think about unrighteousness and godliness. Haman, of course, showed us what unrighteousness looked like, and Esther showed us what godliness looked like. So Haman, how did he demonstrate his unrighteousness? He had pride and arrogance. He had hatred and revenge. Let's look at Esther. We'll read a few verses from Esther, and we'll start with Esther chapter 3 and verse 5. This verse shows what was in Haman's heart. Esther chapter 3 and verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. Haman practiced deception and manipulation, which he thought was going to go his way, and he lost at his own game. He showed a lack of compassion and empathy for others. Because he was mad at Haman, because he was angry at Haman, let's read verse 13. What did he do? He was so mad at one person. He was so filled with wrath. He was so filled with unrighteousness. In verse 13, it says, and letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy and kill and annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, and one day on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, to plunder their possessions. Because he was filled with so much wrath and hatred towards Mordecai, he was ready to kill children, women, the young and the old. But Esther demonstrated godliness. So what are some of the ways that she demonstrated godliness? Well, she had faith in God, and she was courageous and selfless. Esther was probably pretty safe in the position that she was in, being married to the king. She was probably okay, but she was willing to give up her own life for that of her people. Turn over to chapter 4 and verse 16. Esther practiced and demonstrated godliness through her faith, her courage, and selflessness. She said, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat or drink for 3 days, and 3 days, night and day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. She was obedient, and she submitted to authority. Esther chapter 2 and verse 20. Esther 2 and verse 20, it says, "Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. As for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him." So Mordecai acted in the role of her father, and she obeyed him. She showed her godliness by practicing obedience. She advocated for her people and showed humility. All along the way, she was humble, and she was also wise. All right, we made it to the last page of my notes. It's good news. We're doing good. I haven't seen too many yawns. All right, Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8. This is another list that is, again, not directed towards us, not directed to the any churches back at that time or any people. It is specifically talking about evil people, and it's actually talking about evil people in the end time. So Revelation chapter 21, verse 8. "But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all the liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." This is what happens in the end to people who are practicing wrongdoing. But let's compare that to 2 Peter chapter 1, and we'll read verse 5 through 7. 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. "But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love." I believe I heard this was at some point called a ladder passage, because every point is building on top of every other point, and of course we end up at the highest point of love. So we see the connection, this ladder passage here, the ladder and our chutes and ladders, and it's also in the latter part of my message, so it's all coming together. All right, so in this section, again, I've chosen to compare two things that aren't necessarily things that you would immediately compare, but I wanted to compare here lying versus love. Lying versus love. I found articles by just doing an internet search that connected the two, lying and love. So this one article, I'll mention three and read a quote from the third one. This one article is titled, it's written by Dr. Allison Block, "To Live and Lie for Love, Reasons People Lie in Relationships." Now, this article was a positive one. It was positive in that it was advocating for people to not lie in their relationship. But it was a good article because it analyzed what are the reasons why people lie, talked about that. So if you can kind of understand why you're doing some behavior that is not correct, it can help you understand and help you to not do that. So in this case, it was a good article, I believe. The other two, not so good. Forbes has an article by Lacey Rose titled, you ready for this? "Lying is Good for You." Okay. This next one, titled, it's written by Cassie Shortsleeve, "Honesty isn't always the best policy in relationships. Here's when experts say it might be better to lie." So I pulled a little bit out of this article. It's in this section, it says, "But researchers say there's a lot we get wrong about deception, truth-telling, and trust, and that," you ready? "If mastered, lying the right way can actually help build connections, trust, and businesses." Wow. Now, maybe in the human world, maybe if you're in human thinking, dealing in a human world, I don't know, maybe. But that is 100% wrong. And then the article goes on, and this is in quotes, "I believe that we should be teaching our kids, students, and employees when and how to lie," says Maurice Schweitzer, professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, who studies deception and trust. Wow. Wow, that is tough to swallow. We've heard for many years, even decades, about you go as a student to college, or you send your child to college, and you're indoctrinated in the wrong way of life. Well, if you took a class from this professor, he might be telling you some things like this. He might be, I looked him up a little bit, and he teaches, one of the classes he teaches is negotiation. So don't negotiate with this guy. But you go into a class, and he's teaching probably a lot of things that are right, but then he throws in and says, here's the right time to lie, here's how to lie, and you're like, oh, okay, and what a terrible thing. The article goes on and says, there are five scenarios where fibbing might be the best course of action according to experts. One of those, I'll just mention one, it says, if you have someone's best interests at heart, it's a good time to lie. So if you love somebody, there are times where you should lie, according to this article. That's not right, of course, but that's what this article is advocating. What a mixed up, wrong way of thinking. This is where the world is just doing things completely wrong. It's not new. There's nothing new. In the times of Noah, there might have been a similar professor teaching the similar wrong thing. But we know, and it's told us very directly, explicitly, let's not turn there, but God cannot lie. It is impossible for God to lie. Numbers 23:19. Titus 1:2. Hebrews 6:18. God cannot lie. So is the opposite of lying love? Well, in a lot of ways it is. If you're not lying, you are practicing an aspect of love. Let's look at, for our last passage here in this message, Ephesians 5:1-2. Ephesians 5:1-2. We need to put away lying, every form of lying. Ephesians 5:1-2. Therefore, be imitators of God as dear children. So one of the ways that we imitate God is what? By not lying, because he can't lie. He doesn't lie. It's impossible. So one aspect of imitating God is by not lying. And then instead of the lying, we do what verse 2 says, and walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, offering and a sacrifice to God for sweet-smelling aroma. We need to be walking in love and putting away lying. All right. In the game of chutes and ladders, we experience ups and downs on the way to victory. Our lives have some similarities. There are some ups and downs, but we are trying to minimize the downs and maximize the ups. The Bible, as we went through, provides a number of lists that showcase or highlight the wrong behavior. Shouldn't be our primary focus, I don't believe, to focus in on all the wrong behavior, but we need to look at this, look at these, and examine ourselves as we compare ourselves and what we are doing to these. What are we doing as compared to what God says not to do? But there are so many cases where God tells us what is right. He shows us what is right. We should absolutely be focusing on those things and figuring out how we can do more of that in our lives, practice more of that. So as Paul wrote to the church in Ephesus that we just read, let's be imitators of God and making sure that we are walking in his love.